I think we're a minute early, but I think we can start the show. I know that there's probably a lot of confusion wondering where Lester Bush is. None of these gentlemen or lady is Lester Bush. I regret that Lester Bush, his flight was canceled due to weather. So he sends his deepest regrets that he isn't able to participate in this. If that changes your mind of being here because that's the reason you came, I understand. You'll have to ask for a refund from Lindsay. But we brought Matt Harris in, who promises to do his best Lester Bush impersonation. So, although Lester Bush is somewhat enigmatic, it's hard to know how to impersonate him. So I suppose you could just do anything, and they will assume that's a dead-on Lester Bush. Okay. They gave me a script to read, so I'm going to go ahead and read that. Thank you for attending session 374, titled Race and Mormonism, a Roundtable Discussion with Experts minus Lester Bush. Welcome to the closing evening session for Saturday. Man, I feel like that needs to be said with some gusto, right? Welcome to the closing evening session for Saturday! Is that good? Like, don't let it end. Following this session, there will be a Linger Longer with music by the Angela Sophie Band. Following the music, there will be evening storytelling with Robert Kirby, Gina Colvin, and Courtney Clark Kendrick. Tickets are limited but available for purchase at the registration desk. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please silence your cell phones and remain respectful, as if we ever have to say that at Sunstone. As you leave us tonight, we want to thank you all for coming and being part of this Sunstone Symposium. You have now participated in a tradition of Mormon history that is over 40 years old. Mormonism can be what we make it, and your participation helps make Mormonism a little more diverse, interesting, and inclusive. Regardless of your relationship with the Restoration, we claim you as an important part of this community. You are wanted, and your voice is needed. You claiming the identity in your own way is an act of resistance against hate, division, and intolerance. Thank you for having the courage to show up and engage at Sunstone. Please support Sunstone by making a donation, subscribing to the magazine, and by attending our regional conferences. You're all invited to our text to attend our next regional conference in Glasgow, Scotland. Can't wait to see you there. On September 1st, so right around the corner, register at sunstone.org. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework so that folks can get out for dinner on time. So about this presentation, this session is going to be a roundtable open discussion, hence me setting up chairs in a semicircular fashion rather than sitting in a linear fashion at the table. It's going to be an open discussion. We're going to be talking about the former race-based restrictions. We're going to be talking about other issues in relationship with race and Mormonism, getting into some more contemporary type issues. And I'm going to be basically giving 10 prepared questions to them to field. We'll see if there's any balance of time remaining. Depends on how long Newell goes in his answers. By the way, Newell Bringhurst recently re-released his, I guess you would say, seminal book, the first comprehensive book that was published after the lifting of the priesthood ban in 1978 on the topic of race and Mormonism. It's titled Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, The Changing Place of Black People Within Mormonism. That's been a very difficult book to get your hands on up until now. It's printed as a second edition, and it's available at the Benchmark Books counter. So just to give a little biographical information, we'll go ahead and start with Newell since I'm picking on him. Newell Bringhurst is a professor emeritus of history and political science at the College of the Sequoias. He's the author of Brigham Young and the Expanding American Frontier and Fawn McKay Brody, A Biographer's Life, and co-editor of numerous titles, including Black and Mormon and the Mormon Church and Blacks, A Documentary History. Seated on Newell's left is Matt Harris, once again taking the place of Lester Bush. Matt Harris is a professor of history at Colorado State University, Pueblo, and he is the co-author of The Founding Fathers and the debate over religion in revolutionary America. I know that he also has forthcoming biography of Ezra Taft Benson in the works, and recently published a documentary history on Blacks and Mormons along with Newell Bringhurst. Turn my page. Sitting to the left, the other left, sorry. It's my first show, is Darren Smith. Darren Smith is an African-American scholar, author, and blogger. His research and writing focuses on injustices impacting African-Americans and other marginalized groups. He studies the impact of race on U.S. healthcare, the practice of white parents in adopting black and biracial children, religion, sports, and politics. You'll have to remind me of the full title, but he recently published, what was it, last year, Darren? The book that you published was When Race, Religion, and Sports Collide, which has BYU in front and center, right? Okay, great. Devery Anderson is a marketing manager at Signature Books. He has published several books and articles on Mormon history and has a passion for the American Civil Rights Movement. His acclaimed book, Emmett Till, The Murder That Shocked the World and Propelled the Civil Rights Movement, was released by the University Press of Mississippi in August 2015. And then finally, LaShawn Williams. LaShawn is a divorced mother of three children under 10 years old. She's a full-time faculty member, part-time therapist, full-time faculty member of UVU, should be in here, right? Part-time therapist and a lifelong member of the LDS Church. She still believes that her family is eternal. And I can tell you also as a parent of four that I also believe that it never ends. So the way that this is going to go is I'm going to throw out a question that I've prepared that I've also helped them somewhat mentally prepare for. I will let them discuss it, chew on it. Before I move on to the next question, we'll try to keep it somewhat timely. And then I'm hoping to have a half hour in the remaining balance for you guys to ask the questions that I didn't. In other words, the really good questions. So we'll go ahead and start with this. All right. I think Newell, I think you were my first up to bat. He always gets picked on. Okay, so Newell, you've written in the past that the temple and the priesthood restriction evolved over time. You wrote that it went through three stages. First as a practice, then it became a policy, and finally it became enmeshed as a doctrine. In Mormonism. So can you walk us through those three stages, just for a little historical context?
It started as a practice under Brigham Young, and the exact date that Brigham Young inaugurated black priesthood Nile is somewhat unclear, somewhat murky. But from the best we've been able to determine, it appears to have been sometime between 1849 and 1852. And 1852 we usually say as the beginning date because that was the date that Brigham Young first publicized it, that it was a practice. And it was announced at that time in conjunction with the legalization of black slavery in Utah. In fact, the beginnings of the systematic practice of black priesthood denial was intertwined with the inauguration of black slavery as a legal institution. Utah, the only Western territory to legalize black slavery. And so it was inaugurated, announced, and it continued as a practice into the late 19th century. And by the early 20th century, by around 1908, it had evolved. I mean, it was a gradual thing. These things kind of overlap. By 1908, it had clearly evolved into a clearly established policy. And the reason that that date is often cited and is because prior to that time, the church had confronted the issue of both Elijah Abel asking for his temple endowments and Jane James asking for her temple endowments, and they were both refused that, and that forced the church to church leaders, the church hierarchy, to definitely affirm that it wasn't just a practice, but it had evolved into a policy, and so that policy was affirmed in various ways. Most prominent was through the publications of the Utah Genealogical Society. We had a wonderful session earlier today in which Sterling Adams, who's done a lot of work on that, that was probably the major propaganda arm for affirming that it is a clearly established a policy and legitimized through patriarchal blessings in which blacks were routinely assigned either the lineage, the accursed lineage of Cain or Ham. And then by 1949, it had reached the final stage of its evolution, becoming a clear set doctrine. And that was affirmed in two official statements. The first was actually issued in 1949, signed by the first presidency of the church, David O. McKay. David O. McKay was a counselor. He was a second counselor, but under George Albert Smith, who was president at that time, and J. Reuben Clark, who was second counselor. And they signed off on it as, and clearly it states in the 49 statement, that this is the doctrine of the church, and it gives a whole bunch of theological justifications for that as being a clearly set doctrine. And so it remains a doctrine until its final repeal until the 78 revelation. But a further affirmation of it as a doctrine comes in that very controversial statement of 1969, which is issued when David O. McKay is on his deathbed. He's so sick, he can't even sign the final Church First Presidency statement that affirms it as a doctrine. It is actually signed by Hubie Brown and Eldon Tanner. And so that's, in a nutshell, how it evolves. Anybody else want to comment?
Just to say something quickly, with LDS racial doctrine that becomes codified in the 20th century, the best way to think about this, I think, is that it's always evolving. And I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday about the we don't know position, when for 3 or 4 decades, that was the official church line when someone would ask, why can't blacks hold the priesthood? And it was, we don't know. And that first arises in 1970 with this second first presidency document that Newell referred to. And it's so interesting that to tell Bruce McConkie or Joseph Fielding Smith that you really don't know why the ban occurred, that's just nonsense. They wrote books about it. They were very clear and emphatic about why the ban occurred. They were less valiant. They were cursed, all of that stuff. But the we don't know statement emerges out of the turbulent civil rights era when the church is starting to realize that the its racial teachings are causing hardships. And in order to avoid the racial backlash, both with LDS political contenders and also just saints at large, the church is starting to back away from explaining to people in public about less valiant in the curse. And in 1968, this is the last quick comment I'll make, but in 1968, the first presidency has a meeting about this. And they decide in their meeting that they should keep their discussions about their racial doctrine clear, positive, and brief about people of color. That's a conscious decision. And then 2 years later, in 1970, we get the we don't know line that stays in the Mormon lexicon until the early 21st century.
Okay, so the next question is for Devery. So you've researched and written extensively on the civil rights era, and we focus, I think, when we talk about race and Mormonism, we tend to focus a lot on the 19th century origins of the practice, and I don't think that we discuss as much what Mormonism and Utah in general, since this was the highest demographic of Mormons, was like during the Jim Crow era. And how segregated it was, things of that nature. I think that we tend to jump from 1852 to 1978
in most of our discussion. So, you know, Newell pointed out that Utah was the only Western territory to permit slavery, for example. Post-statehood, how segregated was Utah? And I know that, you know, there may have been some history here with lynching, for instance. Can you speak on this?
Yeah, a little bit. When we think of the Jim Crow era, well, we tend to think of the South quite a bit, and how that was defined there was by statute that every part of life was segregated in the South. We've seen the bathroom signs for whites only, coloreds only, drinking fountains, everything, movie theaters where they couldn't keep... where they couldn't really accommodate both races, and black people were excluded completely. It's important to distinguish that. Where they chose not to to do that, then black people were excluded completely. In the North and in the West, like with here, a lot of this boiled down to... we saw this, but we saw it in The discrimination was still there. That was the underlying thing. But we saw a lot of it played out in housing and employment and things like that. And that's what we saw in Utah as well. We're probably familiar with segregation with Hotel Utah. We hear about the singer Marian Anderson who and other black performers who came here and couldn't find housing or couldn't find hotels that would accommodate them. Even the Hotel Utah only did it if they took the freight elevator. And so we saw this type of thing going on. And so that's what we saw here. And in the North as well as in the South, there was the big fear. Now we know in slavery times and in later times, a lot of white men were raping black women, and they were bearing children. The big fear that led to segregation was the fear of black men being with white women. And that's why the races were separated right down to drinking fountains, because that fear of the black man and this idea, this myth of the black beast rapist, that was a fear that the South just could not handle. That's why with the Emmett Till case, he was only 14 years old, and he really didn't do anything. But they portrayed him as this black beast rapist for the sake of the jury. And, of course, a jury, an all-white jury, there's no question that these men would be acquitted. As far as lynchings, I know there was a lynching, I think it was known as the last lynching in the West, or Intermountain West, the Robert... Marshall. That was like mid-20s. 1925. And he was a coal miner. Was accused of, I think, shooting someone at the coal mine, a security guard, or someone in security there. And he was lynched. And close to a dozen men, I think 11 men, were arrested for this. Dozens, over 100 witnesses that just didn't seem to remember anything that had happened. And so this is before a grand jury, not at a trial. This is before a grand jury, and so they were never indicted, these people. And so this is something that we would associate with the South so much. But that happened right here in Carbon County, I believe. And so lynching in Utah... we see exactly the same thing that happened in the South. Now, the South had thousands of lynchings. Mississippi was held the record for that. And but we saw it happen here, and we see so much during the Jim Crow era. If we could talk about Brown versus Board of Education in May of 1954, how many of you are familiar with the talk that Marky Peterson gave just shortly after that? I think it was called Race Relations as They Affect the Church or something like that, where he talks about segregation and this big fear, once again, of interracial marriage. This idea of black men and white women was the big fear, and we saw that in his talk. That was his big fear, that we can't, he said something to the effect that we can't feel so sorry for the plight of the Negro that we would ever embrace them to the point where we would ever consider this happening. He had been quoting an interview with Representative Adam Clayton Powell, where Adam Clayton Powell was asked, "Do you see if integration, you know, becomes the norm, will we see interracial marriage?" And he was frankly that, yeah, one day that will be the case. And that just scared the heck out of Marky Peterson. And so that was really why he spoke about this. And so that same fear in the North between white or black men and white women, or in the South, we saw that in the North too, and anything could happen from there. So.
So as a follow-up question to that, what would have happened to Emmett Till had he visited Utah in, is it 1955? Instead of going to Mississippi?
Well, it's interesting, too. I think back to one example. I'm writing a biography of Willard Richards. And one thing that happened in Nauvoo, there's this black man by the name of Chisholm, I think. Are you familiar with this one? He had been accused of robbing a store in Nauvoo. And these men just whipped him nearly to death. And the next day after that, Willard Richards writes in his journal, and so does Joseph Smith. Well, Willard Richards was keeping Joseph Smith's journal, so he wrote in both, that he took him to the red brick store and was hiding him there from these men because, you know, they nearly killed him and was worried for his safety. And these men, one of them was fined, and then there were other accomplices they figured were with him, and nothing really happened there, I believe. But John Taylor wrote a scathing editorial in the Nauvoo Neighbor about this, saying that this was just such an injustice that happened to him and this and that. So I was, you know, I saw that happen. But usually the case, and that was a case of a robbery. Anytime there was anything between, and this big fear, once again, of interracial marriage or anything that could even lead to it, in Emmett Till's case, it wasn't a robbery, it wasn't his civil rights activism, it was this fear of a black man. So had something like that happened here, had Emmett Till done that here, you know, we had the whole legacy of lynching in the South, too, where the men that killed Emmett Till really thought they could get away with it because no one was ever prosecuted for anything like this. But I think, depending on where in Utah as well, I could see this the same outcome, especially with this big fear, and then when we see the fear that Marky Peterson's talking about and wanting members in general to adopt that attitude, which they pretty much did. I remember when the revelation changed in 1978, everyone was so happy about that, but then right away the first things I started hearing was, but interracial marriage is still discouraged, and gave a lot of reasons for that, different cultures and this and that, but there was still that fear that one race is inferior over the other. In fact, even Bruce R. McConkie, after he talked about forget everything I said and forget everything George Buchanan said and all of us, we spoke with a limited understanding, in the very next, when he revised Mormon doctrine, look under the entry called Races of Men, and he talks about anytime someone isn't white, it means they did something wrong in the preexistence. And he was talking about Asians and others that they still must have done something. And so we couldn't let go of that idea of a race being inferior, even though we had granted the priesthood. And that was up in the 70s. And so you look back in the 50s, I could see Emmett Till, I could see sympathy being for the white men because people knew Emmett Till's killers were guilty, but they felt that if we lose on this one, is what they said, then who knows what can happen, this whole slippery slope. And people in Chicago were writing, people in the South, saying you don't want the same thing to happen in your state that's happened up here. You see white men and black, or black men and white women walking down the street hand in hand, and it just outraged people in Chicago. And so that was the kind of fear that existed in the North as well as the South, and so I could see that happening here with the same outcome.
Anybody else before we move on?
I just have one quick question. Since we're speculating, I wonder, for the 11 men not found in any way attached to the lynching, to the hundreds of people that sold postcards door-to-door for 25 cents of the lynching that they all participated in, do we want to speculate how many of them were active temple goers, temple recommend holders, who were able to answer questions about their dealings with their fellow men? How do we, on the one hand, understand these cultural and social things that happen, yet on the other, doctrinally, find ourselves worthy to worship. In Utah, in Price, where the lynching was, yes. 25 cents a piece, door to door.
Fascinating.
Most are, yes.
Most are online. Mm-hmm. You can find them.
So Matt just said most are online, and you can find them. Anything else?
The aftermath of a lynching, lynchings are deeply associated with the word picnic, and so I noticed that we had a picnic advertised here at Sunstone, so I would encourage you to maybe rethink your wording, just because it's triggering. It's triggering to see that. And so picnics were what led to lynchings. And the horror of a lynching is, eventually when we get to like an open piece, I would love to hear from folks on the panel that could speak to the soul of this investment in whiteness that allows for these sorts of things to happen. And these are your brothers and sisters in church. And you're picking people to kill based on a doctrine that was introduced from Brigham Young during that legislative speech. He spoke nothing except for eternal truths and doctrine in Cain and Abel. So I think I push back a bit on the notion that it was practice, then policy, then doctrine. I think it started off as a doctrinal practice that then we've looked for ways to say it wasn't as bad until it got to this one place. So it's not that these are events that happened isolated from one another. This is a tapestry of trauma that we have for black people, period, and then definitely for black members of the church.
Anybody else before we move on? Excellent, okay. Next question to you, Matt. So what do you think sustained Mormon racial attitudes for 130 years on the prescription of blacks in the priesthood?
Well, that's a tough question. So what sustained attitudes, Mormon racial attitudes about the priesthood ban? And there's a lot of questions or answers I could provide, but I'll try to be brief. A couple of three come to mind. One would be that racism is so structurally ingrained in the heart of Mormonism with manuals, in scripture, in books and writings. And when it's so structurally embedded in the sinews and fibers of the faith, it's hard to really eradicate. So that's the first point. The second point is that you have to look at personalities who were in church leadership, particularly in the 20th century. And one of the things I've learned in my research, and I'm doing a second book on blacks and Mormons since World War II, is that, believe it or not, the apostles in the post-war era, World War II, there are nuances in terms of how they look at their priesthood ban. It's easy to say that they all believe that black people are cursed and they all believe in the less valiant idea. That's not true. And I think, obviously, Hugh Brown comes to mind. Some of folks of a certain generation know Hubie Brown. But there are other folks who don't believe in the curse either, but yet they might believe that black people are less valiant. There are nuances. And in 1979, junior apostle named David Haight was asked by David O. McKay's grandson, why did it take so long to lift the priesthood ban? And Haight's response was, we just never considered it. We just always inherited this uncritically. And that's not entirely true. They had talked about it in 1954. They had talked about it in 1969. They had talked about it in 1972. And then, of course, ultimately, they lift the ban in 1978. But that was Haight's perspective as a young junior member of the 12, who wasn't around during those conversations, by the way. But he said, we just never questioned it. It was just always handed down to us. And so there was a confluence of events in the 1960s and 70s in which Spencer Kimball recognized that it was halting the growth of the church and that there are a lot of things going on. But quite frankly, President Kimball and the rest of his colleagues couldn't determine who had black blood and who didn't. That was a huge issue. They knew they were baptizing black people and conferring the priesthood on them. They knew it was a problem. And sometimes when they learned about it, they turned the other way, depending on where it was and the leadership they needed in the branch of the ward. And in other cases, they had people suspend or stay their hand, which was a nice way of saying, you can no longer be the bishop because you determined doing genealogy that you have African ancestry. You have to stay your hand. We're going to release you as the bishop. You can perform priesthood ordinances at home with your immediate family, but you can no longer do it in public. And you see an unevenness about this in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And so the leaders of the church recognize that this is a huge problem determining who has black blood and who doesn't. They know it's not sustainable. And the question is, why don't they lift the ban earlier? And the civil rights movement just throws them for a loop. They don't want to give the impression that they're going to cave into external forces. And so, and I'll just say one last thought as a teaser that we can talk about later if you want, that Spencer Kimball is going to lift the priesthood ban the minute he becomes the church president in 1974. And the reason why he doesn't in 1974 is because he has the same issues that David O. McKay's faced with a decade and a half earlier. He's got doctrinal hardliners who will not permit this. And then secondly, there are saints in the South who are not ready for this change. And they're very, very attuned to Latter-day Saints in the South who have these hard racialized attitudes.
It's like kryptonite microphone right now, right? I do have a follow-up question for you, Matt. I think that when we look forward to 1978 and some of the maybe, I don't know, I don't want to even call it changing attitudes, but maybe some of the more willingness to accept change from among church leadership, we've attributed some of that to scholarship that had been published, such as Lester Bush's article, right, having maybe informed them in a slightly different view of perhaps that this wasn't originated by Joseph Smith, right? How much of it do you really think is informed by critical scholarship versus cultural, external forces, internal shifts with the church growth? Right. You want to take that one, Darren, for a second?
Yeah, I would say virtually none. I say if you look at Jana Reese's recent survey, you can see the continuation of the ideology that underscored this discussion. You know, when you have 61%, I believe, or whites believing that the curse was legitimate, and you have 70% of blacks believing it's the same thing. So I think you see a continuation of the same thing. Also, I would argue, too, or I would sort of raise the interest flag regarding Mormons really seem to mirror Southern people. I mean, there's just such a every time I come here, I feel like I'm in the South. I just roll back to the South because I see trucks and I see emblems of things that I see in the South. It's really kind of an eerie kind of a sensation. But I would say that I think the expectation that Mormons are somehow removed from the larger spectrum of society really does a disservice, you know, to Mormons because it assumes that Mormons are somehow above all of this stuff. Unfortunately, we're not. Unfortunately, Mormons have had a long history of this, and it has yet to be reconciled by members of the church themselves. And until someone in those red seats say something or articulate something that makes sense, I think it'll continue to be the same way. It'll continue to sort of be passed forward to the next generation. That's kind of how I see it. I mean, because I'm looking at out now and seeing second-generation Mormons taking up the same fight I took up, you know, a couple decades ago, you know. So it's still the same conversation. It's maybe shifting a little bit, but it's pretty much the same conversation in terms of how do you reconcile this stuff? How do you get past this stuff? And I think the big issue, one of the issues, is that there's a huge correlation between authoritarianism, right, racism, and republicanism. They all sort of merge in together, or kind of sort of conflated. So there's something in there. There's something in that messiness that needs to be sort of teased out. I think a lot of it has to do with empathy. The fact that whites have just been taught not to have empathy for people of color, particularly African Americans. If you look at the history of white colonialism, white supremacy, you move that forward into where we are today, and you see some of the acts of just utter ridiculousness going on across the United States. I mean, to me, it amounts to simply a lack of empathy. And we look at some of the social science research around that. Sure enough, there's a lot of stuff that suggests the fact that whites have greater empathy for themselves, less empathy for people of color, whereas people of color have empathy for other people of color and for whites, which is interesting. So I think the moral crisis is really, I think, within at least the white framework, as I see it, is the lack of empathy. And then how do you access that empathy? How do you access it if it's not there? You know, so I think, and you know, maybe in the mainline church it's not there as much, but certainly we have some work to do. And I'm still not seeing any of that. So maybe we can do better in that arena.
I disagree. First, I want to know where you get your 70% number for black people that believe the ban was legit. Second, my comment to that is, I don't think we have a lack of empathy that we're experiencing from whiteness to people of color. I think we have selective use of empathy. I think that what we're looking at, what we need to understand, is that this is about survival. The reason why people of color have empathy towards white people is because we need to be empathetic for y'all in order to, for us to survive. This is not about, oh, let me be empathetic. It's about let me survive. So with this piece about survival, Mormons and Mormons means white right now. White people forget that as Mormons, they had to learn to survive. And I do not like that we had to survive, so we had to be racist to be able to survive argument, but that's one that's going to have to come up because there is a piece of this investment in whiteness. It's a possessive investment in whiteness that says, whatever I have to do to survive as a Mormon, I'm going to do it. And what we look at and what we see today is recognizing that anti-blackness from white Mormonism is what has set up this really gross black-white binary that has all non-black people of color racing to say, as long as I'm not black, I'm better. This proximity to whiteness is now harming all of us because this need to survive the oppression that people experience as being Latter-day Saints, which are already an oppressed religious group, is now filtering down into the interactions of people of color. And if people of color are saying, as long as I'm not black, I'm good, we have a problem because now blackness is at the bottom of everything. And we think that it's, they don't have empathy. Well, no, they do. They have selective empathy. And the part that I don't understand is how do you go from being oppressed and kicked out and run out and exterminated and everything else to then getting to a place of power and then playing this really disgusting, sickening game of how can I make puppets out of people of color? And if I keep these ones on the bottom, then these ones are going to do whatever they can to not be those, and I still get to keep all of them in place. We have a deep, systemic, traumatic problem when it comes for black people in this church, and it's wrapped up with colonialism, it's wrapped up with imperialism, it's wrapped up in white supremacy, and white supremacy is a system that functions like a well-oiled machine since the foundation of this country.
How do we address it then if we talk about the trauma and we talk about what black folks have experienced and so on? So, and you argue that folks have selective empathy, lack of empathy, whether it's selective or not, lack of empathy is what it amounts to in terms of what I see and what I read and in terms of what I study. But in looking at the so what question, you know, everybody, we've written about it, we know a lot about what's happened, so what do we do about it? So how do we access empathy? How do you access it? Is there a way to access that?
I think one of the first things we do is we don't collude with people who write fake apologies to black people about the LDS Church. Speak about empathy then.
Okay. We're going to try to get... I think we can do a good segue, actually, on this, because when we talk about... Can
right. Yeah. It just makes the whole issue even more salient, even more disturbing.
So I would like to actually have more of this discussion, but can we do it in a later question? Can we agree to that? Because we got some good questions coming up where this is appropriate part of the conversation, right? Well, no, we've got it in these questions. But I want to try to be fair to all the people that have joined and do the prepared questions, then we're going to have this discussion here. Okay, so.
I said let it go.
Oh, I'm sorry, Micah. Misha, I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. Okay, so, but I do think that it makes a good segue because, you know, we're at a point, I think, right now, we've had to address our racial past, but I think that as a church institution, they obviously have tried to do it with as minimal internal damage as possible. Which means trying to explain it in a very simplified way. And I'm thinking the Gospel Topics essay, right? And Newell, I'm going to direct this question to you. You've been an open critic of that essay. You've got a book coming out with Matt that addresses not just that essay, but all the Gospel Topics essays, but that one is in there. And I think that you've mentioned that you feel that it's scapegoating Brigham Young in favor of a larger issue within Mormonism that probably should be addressed. Do you want to discuss that for a minute?
Well, I think the wrong word is scapegoating. I think it to use the phrase that Matt and I have kind of thrown Brigham Young under the bus because they focus on him as the guy that was influenced or inspired by the prevailing racial prejudice in the larger society. And I'm very critical of it because it oversimplifies and balderizes the systemic causes of black priesthood denial, which are rooted before Brigham Young becomes president of the church. It's clearly articulated in the scriptural writings of the LDS Church, the basic standard works of the church, starting with the Book of Mormon. One of the things when I did my Saints, Slaves, and Blacks that I thought was a gross omission from previous studies is nobody addressed the impact and the influence of the Book of Mormon in setting the tone and the tenor of Mormon racist ideas. It's clear and explicit in the Book of Mormon, and then as Joseph Smith further elaborates Mormon doctrine or theology in the Book of Moses, the Book of Abraham, and so it becomes part of the scriptural canon. And even though black priesthood denial isn't formally implemented until after Smith's death, it's further elaborated when they start giving patriarchal blessings, as Matt has described in his. He's got a forthcoming essay on patriarchal blessings. It becomes reinforced, and none of those things are addressed in the gospel topics essays. And the whole idea of preexistence, which of course it goes back to the Book of Abraham, so those are the things is completely ignoring, almost completely exonerating Joseph Smith. And that was one of my major criticisms. I wish Lester was here because that was one of my major criticisms of Lester Bush's 1973 seminal article was he didn't even address those basic fundamental issues. Anybody else care to elaborate? Would you care to further elucidate on that? You've done work on that as well.
So the question is the race and priesthood essay weaknesses or criticisms? So I don't have a lot to add on that. I wrote the essay for the volume, and I wanted to say more than just a critique about the race and priesthood essay. I also wanted to have a discussion about Mormon whiteness theology in the 20th century and how Paul Reeve has looked at Mormon racial theology in the 19th century. I looked at Mormon racial theology in the 20th century and how Mormons had racialized themselves. And it used to be in the church that, it's the Lamanites, they're the ones that are racialized because they get cursed and their curse gets lifted. But Black Latter-day Saints are part of this conversation too, even though it's not as public and overt as it is about Lamanites. They're having these conversations about Black Latter-day Saints in private. And one quick anecdote. In 1954, after one of you mentioned Mark Peterson's speech at BYU in 1954, race problems as they affect the church, they had a discussion about this controversial BYU address. And in the Salt Lake Temple in 1954, October of 54, so 3 months after he gave the address at BYU in August, they talk about in the temple with 12 religious educators, including luminaries like Hugh Nibley and Sidney Sperry, a guy at the Institute in L.A. named Paul Dunn, George Boyd, the brother-in-law to Spencer Kimball. So 12 people are there in the Salt Lake Temple, and they're having a roundtable discussion in private that was not meant for public consumption. They're talking about segregation. They're talking about any number of issues. Well, it comes up, Sidney Sperry asked Joseph Illing Smith, who was there accompanying Apostle Peterson, he asked him point blank, is it true that when black people become Mormons that their skin color changes? And Joseph Illing's response was, quote, we have actual examples of when Negroes join the church, their skin color turns lighter, end quote. And to my farms friends out there, I don't know how you read anything metaphorical into that. So there are lots of examples going on with that in private. And by the way, in popular culture picks up on this too. When Ezra Taft Benson's in the Eisenhower cabinet 1953-54, there's a Time magazine article that they just excoriate Apostle Benson for a lot of things. not the least is his farm policies, but also that his church had racialized black people, indicating that they could become white again. And the last thing I'll share with this is that the leaders could not determine for themselves if this whiteness transformation, this literal flesh pigmentation changing, they couldn't determine if it would happen in mortality or in the hereafter. They were of a divided mind about that. Some of them would argue that the skin color would change over time in mortality as they joined the church. Others argued that the full transformation would occur in the resurrection when the curse was lifted. But this stuff is still going on in the 20th century, and it was a handful of apostles who seemed to have been the loudest proponents of it.
LaShawn, my next question's for you, but I have to set it up with a story. It's a conversation that I had with Kathy Stokes. Kathy, for those who aren't familiar, has played a real important role in the past 20, 25, 30 years of blacks in the church. She was invited to this panel. She had a family conflict that she needed to go attend to, so she wasn't able to come. But we had a good conversation on the phone, and she asked me when I invited her to the panel, why would you want me on the panel? And I said, well, you're an important voice, number one. But number two, I feel like we need a woman's voice, particularly a black woman's voice, right, on the panel. And she said, why? And I said, because I think that we often overlook when we're talking about the priesthood restriction that it's also a temple restriction that affected women. And she said something rather poignant to me that I was both frustrated by and it made me very curious. She said, well, we didn't see it that way, speaking as the black women that she was affiliated with. We didn't see it that way. She said, we saw it as just a priesthood ban because, she said, no woman was going to the temple without a husband that was a priesthood holder at that time. So our focus was on the priesthood aspect of it. Once the priesthood aspect of it was done, then we knew the temple would be next. So it wasn't part of the discussion. And it made me think of, perhaps civil rights era mentality of social mobility for women in general, and how you push your husband out first to climb the social ladder in order for you as a woman and your family to be able to gain access to social mobility. And I just wanted your thoughts on this, of where you think that, do you agree with what Kathy says and said, and if not, why not, and what are your perspectives on this?
Okay, first of all, you can't ask me if I disagree with Mama Kathy and expect me to be like, yeah, I disagree. I have a different experience than Mama Kathy because Jane Manning James was not married when she petitioned for access to the temple. So for her situation, there was no, I need a man in order to go to the temple. I think it's important to understand that black families were negatively impacted by not being able to access the temple. Families to be together forever, to experience the sealing power, to be able to heal from enslavement, to be able to heal from white supremacy, destroying black families, destroying black mobility. Like, it wasn't about, maybe for white women, you need to access the temple and the priesthood and everything through your husband. That's what that narrative really reminds me of, is this idea is, I access to the priesthood through my husband. And that's not necessarily the same experience for black women. Talking about women's movements and the movements that happened in the 60s and 70s, that was way after black women had been fighting for equality and access, not because we needed the opportunity to work. We were already working. We wanted to be treated, with decency and respect as women. So for us within the temple, it was a priesthood and a temple issue because our families were impacted. And our families were impacted because our sons were impacted. And our daughters were impacted because our families were seen as less than. You got to remember, you're going to church where you could be baptized, wait to die, and then have somebody do your work for you, maybe, up until the ban was lifted. So to imagine doing that every single Sunday, hearing that you can see the entire smorgasbord in front of you, but you only get this one section. To limit that to black men might be a cop-out. oh, well, it's just the black men that aren't. That's like some sort of cognitive dissonance to make us feel better that this wasn't directed towards us, but this kept our families from being able to be together. It kept black communities from being able to heal from slavery, for the Mormon church to actually be an example of healing and reconciliation through the fact that we promoted families being together for the eternities when you actively had white supremacy destroying black families at every single turn. So I have a different experience from Mama Kathy in that sense, and I don't think any of our predecessors as black women in the church speak to needing a man in order to petition for your rights to access the temple on behalf of yourself and your family.
Any other thoughts? Not that anybody else is qualified. All right. Darren, we're going to bring that survey back up, and you had a question about where that 70% number came from. So this was Jana Reese's next Mormon survey. Is Jana here? She's okay. Okay. So you can ask her about her surveying demographics if you like. I know she's publishing a book with Oxford. I think next year with this with the survey information. I'm sure that she'll have her methodology in there. But anyway, it's on her blog at Religious News Services, and she also presented on it at the most recent Mormon History Association. The survey was conducted among younger Mormons, and when asked about the temple and priesthood ban, 61% of whites and 70% of non-whites, so not blacks, non-whites, yeah, non-whites, right, responded that they believed that the ban was God's will, even if they disagreed with its practice. I guess, Darren, does this surprise you? First of all, and why do you think the percentage is so high among non-whites comparatively?
I think unfortunately, you know, blacks want to be included, feel a part of the organization, so they'd simply mirror what white folks do. I mean, they accept the values, accept the ideas, accept the teachings as true, and they find ways to reconcile those warring tensions within. Whether they go to Genesis, whether they sing gospel, whatever they do to sort of assuage the feelings that they have of exclusion, that sometimes is a part of being a member of the church. If you're African American or black, so I think that there's different ways to do that. So to me, it's indicative of implicit bias. I mean, it's sort of the idea that, you know, if you look at white racial attitudes, whites tend to evaluate themselves as higher than other groups, and then of course African Americans tend to evaluate themselves like white folks, and also have a different sense of looking at themselves as well in terms of the implicit bias test. So I think that again is an example of how the larger system of white supremacy speaks black folks, whether it's in education, whether it's in medicine, or whether it's in the church. I don't see a difference there. I wish there was a difference. I really wish we'd be having a different conversation right now, but it seems to be that this is the trend. So, anybody?
You want to go ahead? Yeah, I'll preface this by the fact that I'm not an active practicing Latter-day Saint. I'm a member of record, but from a Latter-day Saint perspective, I think that there's this inbred belief that the church is led by divinely directed prophets of God, a prophet of God, and it's very difficult to speak up and say, gosh, our divinely led prophet of God made a mistake, because that undermines, I think, the legitimacy of the church and undermines the legitimacy of its leaders. That's the way I see it, as somebody that's kind of on the margins.
That's essentially what I was going to say, is I think when you've got non-whites that are answering this question, you're asking them about the infallibility of the prophets. So the infallibility of the prophets will be why you'll have 70% of non-whites saying, yes, the ban was of God. So I don't have anything more to add besides I agree.
Just kind of reminds me, I remember in 1992, I was teaching an elders quorum lesson, and this, I can't remember if it was the crux of the lesson or what, but I said something about how a lot of the brethren taught that black people couldn't hold the priesthood because they weren't valiant in the pre-existence, they were cursed, the Cain, all that stuff. And I said, I hope that nobody believes that anymore. Well, for me saying I hope no one believes that anymore, I got turned into the stake president. The stake president wrote me a letter and said, you should never have said that because you don't know why the Lord chose not to give black people the priesthood. And I was thinking at the time, you know, yeah, exactly right, the same thing. People just can't handle the thought. I mean, we can handle the thought of, I suppose, of a church leader making a mistake, but one that lasts 120-some years and hurts a lot of people. It's hard for members to really accept that that can happen when you have prophets, seers, and revelators, you know, leading the charge. And that stake president couldn't grasp that, you know, because that had been taught by so many people, you know, the highest levels of the church. And for me to contradict them, and then today, you know, I hope he's read the Gospel Topics essay, and I hope I got the last laugh on that with him. That was in Washington State. I haven't talked to him in years, but that's when it really hit me that they can't handle, you know, trying. I was trying to be, you know, trying to be inclusive and to shed, you know, at least some degree of racism in people's thoughts, and I was the bad guy for that. And so I thought, you know, we've got a long ways to go, and we've got a lot of attitudes to change before we're ever going to get anywhere with this one. So,
one final comment. Go ahead.
Just a quick thought. So I asked a person who is in the know last year, I said, why did it take so long to get a race and priesthood document? This is a tangible artifact that Latter-day Saints can point to and say, my church doesn't teach that black people are cursed anymore, and which is that's a nice thing. So why did it take so long? And my informant said, because there are members in the 12 who don't think that racism is a problem. And of course, that wasn't good enough for me. I wanted to know where the bodies were buried and who the names were. And so I pressed, and there were two senior apostles, Elder Packer and Elder Oaks, who didn't think it was a problem.
So here's the thing that I'll add to that, because I think it's very easy for us to scapegoat our leaders as infallible, but I think the biggest thing about that is, if the leaders are wrong, what does that mean about me? As a black person in this church, I had to grow up questioning and answering my own questions about my worth and my value as a black person, because I wasn't hearing it from my leadership. And I think the hard part for y'all that are not black is, you got to look at you. It's not just that the prophet is messed up. If the prophet has messed up in the prophet and I believed it, what does that say about me? That's what y'all can't deal with. It's not that the prophets might be wrong, it's that you might be wrong. And it's that you haven't done anything about it. Like, I'm so intrigued by those of you who study black people. Like, what do you hope your work will do? How do you measure its progress? How do you measure it dismantling or affecting this conversation? Or is it just an intellectual exercise for you? Because a lot of us have to live this every single day. And, like, I'm listening to you all who are having this conversation. You're having a very different experience in this conversation than I am, because you experience my experience very differently than I do. And if y'all are implicated in my oppression, what does that mean to you? And what are you doing about it? It's cool to write a book. It's great to do a documentary, but what do you do on Sunday? Your stake president says, hey, don't say that anymore. Do you show him your book? Like, what do you all do? That's the question that I have, because if the power of you all in this room, forget the 12 or the 15. I knew I didn't like Oaks anyway. Thank you for validating that. I only have like two or three that I like right now anyway. But if it's us in this room, and those of you who are scholars who have done this work, for what? You know, that's the question from me at the bottom. For what? Because that work should be doing something to move this forward, more so than just documenting it. Where's the movement? Because if our prophets are wrong, then okay, cool. How about we as people with common consent say, hey, let's stop doing this? Because you're making me look bad. As a white person, you make me look bad.
Unless you want to move on. No. Sorry. Well, I was going to comment on scholarship. So scholarship matters. We didn't address that earlier. Scholarship matters. I had the privilege of going through the Spencer Kimball papers a couple of 3 years ago, and I was curious about the kinds of articles that he collected, that he marked up. That was always interesting. And there was a lot of interracial marriage stuff that Devery appealed to a minute ago or talked about, that Spencer Kimball had a number of articles about the fearing interracial marriage. But he also had an article by the guy left of me, to the left of me, by Newell Bringhurst, a 1978 article he published in the Utah Quarterly, and he marked that up. He also had Lester Bush's article in Dialogue in 1973. And while it would be an overstatement, a gross overstatement, to suggest that my good friend Newell and Lester Bush, their work had changed Spencer Kimball's mind to lift the ban, it certainly shattered the mythology that the ban began with Joseph Smith, and they were extremely careful about this. And just one quick anecdote, Homer Durham, who was the church historian in the late 1970s, he replaced the late, great Leonard Arrington, he sent a BYU professor a note. I was tempted to say email. But he sent him a note in 1979 to the BYU professor, and he said, "We have to have something in BYU studies published that suggests the ban began with Joseph Smith. This is really important to us." And so I don't want to pick on this BYU professor who's still alive. But anyway, the piece got published in 1979, and there were critics who just blasted it, including Lester Bush. And he said, this is terrible. There's no evidence for this. This is flimsy generalizations. And the editor of the journal in 1979 wrote back and he said, "I feel your pain. I know this is bad scholarship, but there was great pressure from Salt Lake to see that this was published." So they're trying to sustain the idea that Joseph Smith was the perpetrator and the originator of the ban when scholarship by Newell and Lester revealed otherwise. So Spencer Kimball, and we know Mark Peterson, we know Bruce McConkie, they are reading this stuff. Scholarship does matter. Last question, or last thought. Mike Otterson, the church PR guy, he told me a couple of years ago, he said, "We read every Mormon blog, mommy, whatever it's called. We read all the progressive liberal blogs for Mormons. We know exactly what's going on." And I said, "What do you do with all that when you read it?" He said, we keep the people above us informed about what Latter-day Saints are saying. It matters. That's what he said.
Trying to figure out what question I want to go to next, because I think we're going to need to shorten this up, but I think it's been a good conversation so far. LaShawn, I want to ask you the next question. I want to reject the idea of a singular black experience in Mormonism, particularly contemporary Mormonism. I'm not talking historical, I'm talking the black experience now. What kind of internal tensions do you see existing within among black Mormons that you affiliate with, that you are aware of, that you see? What kind of internal tensions are you seeing that we, maybe us white people, are just completely oblivious to?
The kind that I want you to remain oblivious to. You haven't earned the right to hear our story. So I wouldn't share that with you. You don't know what to do with it. You don't even know what to do with yourselves at this point. Why would I share what's most vulnerable and what's damaging and hurtful and something within my community? I wouldn't give that to you. Not because I don't know you, I don't like you. I don't know you. And I don't know your intentions. I'm like, that's this whole thing. I never said scholarship didn't matter. But you're using my experiences, and you're profiting off of them, and then doing what with them is the question. Because if we've had scholarship for this long and they're reading everything, then they don't care. That's what I'm hearing, is that they don't care. So scholarship matters, but they don't care, so then does it matter? If we continue to be fodder for scholarship, I mean, to what end? To what point? That's something to think about. So no, I wouldn't feel comfortable sharing our internal tensions, not in a group like this that stays with black people, for black people, for our growth.
I think that's a very fair answer. I appreciate that. Yeah. Does anybody else want to speak on that?
I'm just having a good time, you know. I'm just listening and trying to catch the vibes that's going on. I wanted to sort of just agree with Matt. I mean, I think the scholarship does matter. I think we need to have, you know, to capture that experience that LaShawn's talking about, I think we need to have more people writing about it, more people of color who are writing about their experiences and putting it on wax so folks can read it. Some people are reading it. I mean, if people didn't read it, we wouldn't have this room, wouldn't be full up with folks. So people are reading the material. So, but in terms of, no, probably not. And I think it goes back to the idea I mentioned earlier in reference to the idea of authoritarianism, the sort of the whole political ideology around the Mormon body, the Mormon experience lends itself to not really giving a whole lot of, you know, caring much about at least black folks that much. Now, we care about Love Loud, we care about that, but we don't care much about the black experience. I just want to say that.
I find myself in a kind of an odd position, because I think it overstates the case to say that the church hierarchy doesn't care. I think what is frustrating is that the response or reaction or bringing about change among leaders comes at a very glacial pace. I think they care as long as, you know, if you keep hammering it home, you know, repeatedly. I mean, you see the change. You know, the church is I think in many ways in a crisis situation in terms of retention of membership, in terms of growth, and particularly in the United States. And you know, the statistics are out there to prove that. And I think that, you know, these new leaders you know, are scrambling to figure out, how are we going to, you know, stem this this decline within the American church? I mean, the growth that's being sustained, of course, is being sustained internationally. And ironically enough, I find it crazy and ironic that the greatest growth is in sub-Saharan Africa. I find that tantalizing. I never thought I'd ever see this in my lifetime. But I think that church leaders respond and care, but it's at a conservative, glacial pace. That's my take on it.
Just want to share a quick story about the Gospel Topics essays. Newell and I talk about this in the introduction to our book on the Gospel Topics essays. But we have one of the essays I think I'm most proud of is the background and context to the essays, which is an unknown story. And I'll be very brief. It was because of the essays were published because of the activism of a Latter-day Saint back east who had taken it upon himself. I'm going to simplify the story for the interest of time, but had taken it upon himself to do some surveys, to survey Latter-day Saints, and he's very educated, worked with some other folks. But anyway, he did a whole bunch of stuff, and Jander Rees has picked up on some of his work, but he did a whole bunch of stuff, and he worked behind the scenes with a couple of general authorities whose ears he had. And they didn't know how it would work, but he had, and this, we talk about this, we name names and all this stuff, but he goes to this one Latter-day Saint. He's a middle-aged person, about my age, late 40s, works with a couple of general authorities who are receptive to this faith crisis, and then the general authorities, their 70s, they then push it up to some of the apostles, and some of the apostles just think this is crazy, this is nuts. They put their head in the sand, they ignore it, and then there's a couple of other apostles, including Dieter Uchtdorf, who gave a conference talk in 2013 about mistakes that general authorities had made. Some of you know that. I read about it. And anyway, he had just seen the surveys of these disgruntled Latter-day Saints and how anguished they were over the race issue, over a whole number of other issues. And Uchtdorf had given that statement in October of 2013, and the Race and Priesthood essay was published 2 months later in December of 2013. Three of the general authorities with whom this man worked doing all of these surveys thanked him in emails. You were the one that pushed these essays forward. So I think it's so, Newell points out that these things often take place at a sort of a slower process, and that's true. It took this guy 3 years to work with the authorities, but the Gospel Topics essays are the fruits of his labor.
Is there a growing sense of battle fatigue among Black Mormons over these topics, this issue?
I was exhausted the moment I sat in this chair, because I knew how this was going to go. The fatigue is knowing what I'm up against, knowing what's going to come up, knowing what's going to be said, knowing what's going to be weaponized, knowing that this is going to be recorded and that someone's going to hear it and to use it to fit their needs. I don't understand completely what the need is to protect the organizational church the way that we do. The notion that, well, yeah, scholarship matters and they're reading and then it moves really, 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 really slowly, that's because it doesn't harm people when it moves really, really slowly. But those of us who are waiting for it to move at a restoration pace aren't calmed by hearing that it moves at a glacial pace. We've been hearing forever that we're in the last days and we're the last ones at the last days. And scholarship, if it matters, knowing that the Race and the Priesthood essay was 50 to 60 pages long and got watered down to 4 or 5, but you want me to believe that scholarship matters and that they're reading. They're reading and then, okay, they care, but they don't care, but then how are they demonstrating their caring? This is an exhausting thing to do. Exhausting. And it's always knowing that as the sole female on an all-male panel, I have to be very careful of how I speak and what I say because of how it can be weaponized about me as an angry person or someone with internalized hatred because I speak up. I was exhausted the moment I sat down.
So, Darren, I'm going to go back to you. So among non-believing or post-Mormons, I think probably defines a lot of those in this room, it's become kind of popular to identify ourselves as cultural Mormons, right? In the same sense that a Jew could grow up Jewish and consider themselves culturally Jewish, or Catholics who don't attend Mass often, culturally Catholic. But I get the sense that this is an easier attitude for white Mormons to adopt than it would be for a black Mormon. So my question to you is, can a black Latter-day Saint retain an identity as a cultural Mormon if they were a non-believer? Or is the social pressure to continually justify your participation in a mostly white church just too great to be able to have a secular identity within the religion?
I think that hits at the heart of racial battle fatigue. You talked about that earlier. Yeah, I mean, hell, I want to say anything. I don't want to tell anybody I'm Mormon. I don't want that heat. I already got enough heat as it is. I don't want any more heat, right? People asking me why I'm this, why I'm that. I got to explain to people, and most folks are not going to understand. Most Americans think race is about individual acts of meanness, one race against another. That's the major. Their major understanding of race. The average American off the street thinks that's racism. They don't have any idea about the systemic quality of it, the enduring nature of it. So, I mean, you guys are asking some tough questions. I mean, some of these are very interwoven, but if the church is very traumatic, if it's traumatic for folks of color and it's a stressor, then maybe folks of color need to leave and find another organization that's more inclusive if it's not working. I mean, if it's so much pain and suffering with it, maybe it's time to bounce as opposed to being a martyr. You know, I don't know. I mean, where I am, I don't go anymore. I just can't fool with it no more because I just can't hear the conversations in the quorum meetings, and I break it down for them, and they're not trying to hear it. So I don't feel my spirit being reaffirmed in that space. I just can't do it. So I don't know how other black folks do it. I know how I've been able to make some sense of it in my own experience. I've tried to write about it and articulate it. It's hard being a scholar, practitioner, in betwixt and betweener. It's very hard. It's messy. And I don't know if there's an answer. What I do, how I've been able to find some peace, is I meditate. I try to meditate and focus on my breathing. You know, and take me to my happy place so I can not have to deal with these, you know, these vexing social issues that I can't escape from. We talk about the oppression of black women. Black men have been oppressed too in the church. Black misandry. I mean, black men have been oppressed too. I mean, if you all follow the work of William Smith's work on racial battle fatigue and Mormonism, it's a phenomenal piece that's coming out. It looks at this in detail. It looks at the sort of the physiological responses that occur when you are asked to do things like this. You know, it's coming out it's not quite done yet, but it'll be out hopefully by 2019. It'll be an article. It'll be an article, probably in a social science journal. Yeah. So, but nevertheless. So I don't know how to answer that question other than my own experience. I just don't go. I just can't handle it. I can't handle it. I can't handle Republicans right now. I can't handle Trumpers right now. I just can't fool with it. And so I feel like when I'm in sacrament meeting, I'm sitting around a lot of people who believe in that stuff what Trump believes in that, so I can't fool with it. So.
Just really briefly, as a professor, when I speak with my students, I tell them very quickly, no one sees me coming when I walk into the room as a Mormon. They see me coming as a black person. So you speak to, do we have to overcompensate or anything? I know how to speak Mormon when I need to speak Mormon. I know how to access the privilege that comes with letting somebody know that I'm safe. I know the words. I know the lingo. I know what to wear. I know when to not wear sleeves. I know how to do exactly what I need to do to survive being a Black Mormon. In no sense of the word would I feel that I'm a cultural Mormon. Maybe regional, like because of where I grow up, where I live, I might feel that. But culturally, I'm a Black person. And none of that ends once I become a Mormon. I'm a Mormon because it's my religious home, not necessarily my cultural home. There are a lot of cultural things about Mormonism that do not speak to me as a Black person. So I think the notion of being able to be a cultural Mormon but not like a real Mormon is this dissociative thing to detach me from the oppressive structure of Mormonism on Black people. I'm culturally Mormon, so I'm not a bad, you know, oppressive racist one, but I still associate with them because... fruit or potatoes. Like, I don't have that. A lot of Black folk that I know, it's about the religiosity and it's about Jesus. And the only way I'm able to go to church on Sunday is because I've got three little kids that I know I have to go in here and check and deconstruct and say, that's wrong. We don't believe that. That's not true. Who said that in primary? Let me know. Like, I have to watch out because my kids get indoctrinated with stuff. Well, mommy, that's wrong. Says who? All you need to care about if they're talking about Jesus, listen. If not, don't. Early. And so for my kids, like, that's why I keep going. And for my religious growth, my spiritual growth, I don't know any Black person that necessarily gets rid of our cultural background, our cultural roots. I'm still very connected to the Southern Baptist community of my mama and my daddy and my aunties and my uncles. And that's where I go. And I try and bring that with me into church. And when I do that, anytime that I say, let's just focus on these two verses right here and let's expand them, people have a good experience. Because they realize, oh, you can do more than correlation. Well, yeah, let's get into the gospel. So culturally Mormon, it's too associated with white privilege for me to consider myself a cultural Mormon. Religiously, I will continually speak about being a Christian. That's a member of the Mormon denomination. But cultural Mormonism, for me and for a number of folks that I know, that's not how we look to identify ourselves.
Thank you. I know that we're a little running a little over on time, and I really would like the audience be able to ask some questions. So I'm gonna try to just ask a couple of more questions, but I think that they're important, so I will only get them in there. So the first one will be on following up this conversation here. Is there a propensity, you think, among Black Mormons that are active to have to prove a higher testimony, to have to prove that they have a more solidified testimony of the restoration and of what Mormonism teaches unique to Christianity, not just for inside acceptance, but also because you've got Black Baptist family members who are probably wondering why you're still in this church. Right, so what are your thoughts on that?
Do you want to take this one? This notion of having to prove yourself, I mean, I think it goes back to the fact that I know how to speak Mormon when I have to speak Mormon. It's code switching. Not necessarily proving myself, it's knowing when to code switch. And that still goes back to survival for me. Anytime someone feels like they need to understand or give value to or evaluate my experience, if I'm Mormon enough for them, that's a personal problem. That's not anything that I'm going to engage with unless it's a relationship that I value. And usually relationships that I value don't question my worth, my identity, or my integrity as a Mormon. Beyond that, I don't defend racist institutions, and I don't defend racism. I work to see what do I need to contribute so far as an education. When I can do it, if I can't do it, unless I'm being paid an hourly rate, I don't do it. It's too much. I don't go to church to have to feel like I gotta work and fight people. I go to get my testimony boosted. That's what I attend for. I no longer feel a need to prove my worth as a Black Mormon to Mormons or to Black people.
What was the question again?
Do active Black Latter-day Saints have to exhibit a higher testimony even than whites in order to be accepted internally and also because of external?
Well, I mean, I'm looking at this as a social scientist, looking at trying to understand the dynamics of why Black Mormons stay active and practice their faith. Many practice their faith just like any other white member. They believe it. They have a testimony of it. They believe it. But they even believe the rhetoric to the racist rhetoric as well. That's the problem. They can't parcel out that. They can't make the distinction between some can, but a lot of Black folks struggle. It seems that if they
run counter to that, they might be ostracized, which is true. They probably would be ostracized. I mean, all the things that most blacks would tend to assume about what would happen to them if they had ideas like, you know, liberation Mormonism, right? Trying to, you know, like a lot of black folks I know who are trying to do that type of work, liberation Mormonism. I tried, man. It didn't work. Shit. It didn't, pardon me. It didn't work. It just didn't work. I mean, we need more Democrats in the House, I guess. I don't know. It just seems just like it's not going anywhere. So I don't know if it's not. I don't know what to do to change it. I would say meditate. That would be one way. Tap into the empathy centers of your mind, and that would sort of help. But beyond that, I don't know what. I mean, if you know, shit. I don't know. I really don't. So.
But, like, the empathy centers are in our scriptures. Mourn with those that mourn. That's empathy. Comfort those in need of comfort. That's empathy. Like, I don't think we need to go and recreate anything new if it's already in our scriptures. If we have Christ as our example, and if we're not doing what Christ did, Christ is empathetic. So if I can't be like Christ, then don't call yourself a Christian. And I say I'm a Christian and that Mormons are Christian, then act like Christ. And if they're not, I have every single right to say, mourn with me. If you can't mourn with me, ask Jesus to help you and come back and try again. And that's a baptismal covenant. So, I mean, our empathy centers, they're there. Like, we can't scapegoat and try and say that we don't know how to do it. We don't want to, but we don't want to say that we don't want to, because that really makes us accountable. That's our agency. And then we have to really say, I'm choosing not to do this, but I'm blaming it on the infallibility of the prophets. I'm blaming it on a lack of empathy. I'm blaming it on these things outside of me to make me less accountable. And that can't be how we that can't be how we function. We can't function that way.
I would just add, for me, it has to be more than anecdotal. I mean, I need to see some evidence to support it, to support this, the notion that you know, empathy is something that white folks lack. You know, and so sure enough, in the literature, it's quite clear that whites as a group, and these are large studies, and I'm happy to provide this material to anyone who wants to look at it. Whites as a group, it may not be you individually, but as a group, tend to have less empathy for black Americans in particular. Right, so empathy is something that you might have it there. It might be intuitive, it might be inherent, but it's something that has to be cultivated still. Particularly if there's inherent biases that are there, that seems to be there, sort of automatic biases that seem to be there regarding black Americans, that really need to be sort of sorted out within the white psyche. So I think until that happens, we're going to be talking about this. You know, 20, 40 years later, we'll still be talking about the same thing. So there's got to be some changes in terms of what whites have to do, not so much what people of color have to do, but what do whites have to do in order to make the environment better for those who don't look like them.
I agree. And what I'm going to add to that is, I don't want it to leave me right now. It's leaving. It'll come back.
If it comes back, grab the mic. Quick. Okay. This is going to be my last question. Let's talk about white savior mentality and white progressive Mormons who are inserting ourselves in this, which defines us, right? Are we making things better or worse, number one? Number two, do you need our social capital in order to expand this to a broader audience?
It came back to me. So as I bring this in and then I answer, I'll address your two questions, but I feel like that's a question for you all to really sit with and kind of start trying to articulate. With regard to whiteness and lack of empathy, this is the one thing that I think keeps my feet inside this church, because I believe if Mormons, as whiteness, as a white religion, if their experiences with oppression, with exploitation, with extermination, if that hasn't forced empathy for them to be able to be the one group of white folks who get it and can actually go out and do work to change it, that is why I push so hard. Because if anybody should be able to do it as white people, it should be white Mormons. Because they're one of the few who experienced it in a way that was that had a negative impact. And they have the example, they have the blueprint of being able to survive hatred in such a way that it baffles my mind that they chose whiteness over empathy and made other people have to survive their hatred. Now, white progressives and white savior mentality, I forget what the question was, but just stop doing that. Just stop being white saviors. Like, that's just really the quick answer. Are you doing more harm? You're only doing harm because you won't do your own work. You keep coming and asking, what do we need to do? What do we need to do? Y'all are doing the scholarship, you're writing and everything, but then what are you doing with it? I already know what I'm going through. You're writing about it. What are you, how are you taking it back to other white people? If y'all can't do your work, you can't help me. Do I need your social capital? Do you know what to do with it? I don't need it if you don't know what to do with it. But I think there's this thing of, well, I've got it, and I can help it, and I'm white, and da-da-da-da, but you don't know what to do because you won't do your own work. And that's what I really kind of want to hear you all as white people discuss. What do we need to do? Like, what do you guys think? We can't keep asking people of color and black folk what to do. Like, what we created and benefit from a system of white supremacy. How do we dismantle, deconstruct it with the work we've already done? How could I see my work about Emmett Till or about black folk in the scriptures or about blackness after the civil rights? How could I see that changing white supremacy in the church? How can I make white people and white Mormons specifically see, hey, we've benefited because we've been able to access whiteness. But there was a time when we were not treated like white people. We got to get back to our roots of being the oppressed, the exploited, the exterminated, and the shutouts so we can actually start doing this work. Get back to your roots and get back to your authenticity. But until you do that, don't offer me social capital. Because it's like you don't really want to give it to me. You just want to offer it and say, well, I tried. I offered you my social capital and you didn't want to let me do it because you think white people are terrible. That's not it. Y'all don't know what to do with it. So that's my piece is the progressive movement co-opts so much of the black experience only because white people are used to the entitlement that says I don't get treated as an oppressed person. This is why you'll see different movements of whiteness co-opt the black experience because how dare someone treat this white minority group like black people? That's wrong. And so we fight for that. Okay? But then we stop when it would come to us treating black people in an effective, appropriate, and empathetic manner.
I can't remember the question again. What was the question? I keep forgetting the question. White savior. Oh, yes, white savior. I agree, stop doing it. In terms of allies, yes. The more, the merrier. The more the merrier. I love white allies. Bring them on. I think the best white allies that I've found are transracial adoptive parents. They seem to be, of all the white folks that I've encountered, they seem to be much more willing to do the hard work that the average white person is not willing to do. They have a reason to do it because they have a child. And they want to be able to understand their child's experience and be able to understand how to help that child deal with some of the racist actions that are coming their direction. So I think that the future of race relations lies in the hands of white adoptive parents. Wherever you are, if you're out there, somebody, holla, holla. But at any rate, in terms of, what else can white people do? They can continue to do what Matt and Newell and Devery are doing, right? And also in other, and Newell mentored me. So, I know Newell because I cold called him about, 10 years ago, Newell?
Yeah.
Maybe about 10 years, a long time ago. When I was going through these struggling with the similar questions that so many black folks struggle with, my place in the church. And it led me to Newell, and it led me to other things, and Matt led me to Matt, and then Lester. So, I was looking forward to seeing Lester. By the way, Lester was, a quick story about Lester, real quick. When I was deployed in 2008, I applied for a job at the CIA. Lester was the doc at the CIA. He was retired then. When they found out that I knew Lester Bush, they flew me out to D.C. They even offered me the job. So Lester got some clout with the CIA. He got some clout with the CIA. So, but nevertheless, I there was a time that I hated white people. I don't hate white people anymore. I'm a recovering hater of white people. But I do believe that scholarship is necessary. I do believe that allyship is necessary. I think we can't do it without the help of all of our allies, whoever they may be.
So LaShawn, yeah, I know we need to get going. LaShawn opened up the question to all of us as to what are we doing, right? Do we even know how to use our social capital, right? And I think that's, I mean, I'm the first one to be completely embarrassed and say, I did this because Greg Coford Books, my employer, said, I need you to set up some sessions at Sunstone. That's it, right? If it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be at Sunstone, right? So I did it because I got paid, just to be honest, right? And I'm embarrassed about that. I think that we need to take a self-check. So I would love to hear more, but we're out of time. I would love to get at least 10 minutes, if that's okay, because there's no sessions after us. There's nobody coming in here setting up. If we can get 10 minutes of Q&A from the audience, that means probably going to get two, three questions, and that's about it. I think the audience deserves that. What do you think?
I'm fine with it.
Okay. All right. Okay, so we got a microphone set up here. So feel free to make your way up to the microphone if anybody has anything that they'd like to ask that they'd like to hear discussed.
A couple of things. A couple of years ago, in my ward, we were having sacrament meeting on Martin Luther King's birthday. And I'm sitting next to a black guy. And, of course, they don't even mention Martin Luther King. They don't even acknowledge it. I apologized to him. And he said, "Oh, don't worry about that. That's American culture. That's American politics." He said, "I'm from Africa." That kind of gave me hope. That's the part of the world where the church is growing, and it was okay with him that American politics didn't get in the way.
Where did you say he was from?
Africa.
Africa, the entire continent.
Sorry. What? I guess it was just a comment, right? So, yeah.
I have a lot of thoughts. Somatic experiences. I'm focusing. Okay. One, I want to point out that this contributes to our battle fatigue. There's only a handful of us here, people that look like me, and Darren, and LaShawn, and Spriggs and Beck. Like, there's only a few of us who will come into these spaces. And when you go to, if you've ever been to a quote-unquote, like, black movie, if you've ever seen a Tyler Perry movie, Madea, anything like that, there's something that happens often where there's a joke that might be, like, a little questionable. And white people who have been to a lot of those movies tend to look at the black people to see if the black people are laughing. And if the black people are laughing, then they laugh. They hold back, and then they laugh. And there were points in this conversation today where jokes were made or comments were made about the lightening of the skin. Or there was a couple other times where this audience, who's mostly white, roared in laughter. And I wasn't laughing. And at first I hugged my head in shame because I felt upset about this idea that's so violent, that the most beautiful, wonderful thing about me, my race, is challenged and is said to be a curse. That's harmful to me and traumatic to me. And this audience laughed. And Dan wasn't laughing, and LaShawn wasn't laughing, and the brown folks in the room weren't laughing. A couple of us were hanging our head in shame. And that's the work, friends. Like, that's the work that we're talking about. And I want us to, now we're starting to know what that means. Look around. You have a first thought, have a second thought. Look around and see who is laughing, who is crying. That's the empathy piece. That's the work. So we're not all going to be activists. We're not all going to be scholars. But we can all be... We all can be empathic, and even though we're not right now, we've got to work on it, friends. And just take your cues. Look around. How are the people that we're talking about right now reacting to what is being said and done? That's our first thing we want to do. If it's about an LGBTQ person, how are the gay people in the room reacting to what's being said? If it's about black or race issues or about women, how are those people looking, feeling, acting? Are they crying? Are they laughing? Maybe I should take my cues from them. That's mirror neurons. That's how we have empathy. We build empathy through mirror neurons, where I recognize my humanity recognizes yours. This is neurological. This is neurobiology. That's how we start to build those pathways and strengthen that empathy pathway. It's not just an abstract idea. This is neurological. But if you're so busy just laughing or having whatever reaction you want to have, you won't get there. But Darren and a whole lot of other black folks really do want our white brothers and sisters and allies to be in the trenches with us, but it does start with each of our own work, your work. So that's my comment. The question, not a question.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Comments back? Feedback?
When I was 4 years old, my family moved to North Carolina, and we're all Mormons, my parents both from Idaho, and so it was a pretty new experience for them. I was too young to know the difference. One day, my mom came down early to pick up my brother and me from junior Sunday school, which they had in those days, and she got there early, and the teacher, of course, white, was teaching a story of Jesus, and she had some pictures that had come from some evangelical printing house. It wasn't Mormon-produced stuff. And it showed Jesus with a group of children around him. Some of the kids were black. And the teacher was very uncomfortable with that, apparently. And she reassured us, four-year-olds, that, of course, Jesus loves the white children more than he loved the black. When my mom went home that day, she told my dad, "We cannot raise our kids in North Carolina." And so he gave up his job at Duke, and we moved north. 10 years later, we're in a Pacific Palisades ward. Leonard Arrington was in after we were there, and the attitudes were just the same. And so my question is, with white people heading for the exits at an alarming rate, how could black people even want to be in this church? Now, LaShawn, you say that it's to build your testimony. The last few years I was active, every time I went to my reactionary right-wing, Trump-loving ward, it hurt my testimony until it finally just destroyed it. So, you must have a better ward than I do.
I have an amazing ward. I have awesome bishops. I have great leaders who know that if something is going to happen, I'm going to be someone that speaks up to it. I've got amazing ward members who will check other people so I don't have to. I've got folks who see me and who say, "No, that's wrong," and they back me up. For me, going to church is not easy. It's exhausting. It honestly is. And so I've learned to supplement. That's a big thing for me.
So I wanted to make two comments. I never had a testimony. And so for me, I'm not buoyed by a testimony of anything to keep me there. And so cultural Mormonism for me is a way of saying that I still have to identify with the experience that I grew up with. I can't run away from that. I can't go back to a belief that buoys me here. But what I wanted to ask about is because this seems to come up so many times. People talk about the reason that they stay is because they have a testimony. They are called to this. And so their testimony may be something where God tells them, "You're okay, regardless of what these leaders say." And so what I'm wondering is, what is, can white people and can straight people and can men explain to me why it is whenever we're having these conversations about black people, about LGBT people, about women who have testimonies and who have spiritual experiences, what is it about your experience where you don't seem to recognize that someone can have a calling from God that seems to put them in a place where imperfect humans are still going to be doing stuff, and yet, I don't understand this. And another thing I would say is, kind of bouncing off this question, what is it about white Mormons' belief in God, kind of associating this, where people value the leaders and are willing to put stuff on God? Like, it seems to be like there's this idea where no one wants to accept that people can be racist, and that's not on God. And so then there's all these questions about how can black Mormons stay? How can LGBT Mormons stay? And it's like, what do you think about God? For you to think that people are going to let what people are doing, like, is church for you just about what people are saying? And is what leadership saying, like, all that matters to you? And therefore, knowing that leaders are imperfect means that no one should engage? Because I see every human is doing weird stuff. I can't bounce out of humanity.
Right.
So I don't understand why there's always this confusion about why someone who's oppressed could stay in that situation when, even though they're saying they have testimonies, they have these experiences. I don't understand that. So.
That wasn't for me.
I fall into all sorts of fun little categories, black, LGBT, was Mormon for most of my life, though I never believed. Right before I stopped attending church, and I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, right? So you kind of expect certain things. Pretty liberal place. It was one of the best wards I've ever been in. Sunday school one day, sitting in the foyer like I normally did with my Starbucks. I'm telling you, it was the Bay Area. And one of my friends came out from the chapel and said, "You will not believe what Brother so-and-so just said." You know, hearing the name, I said I probably will, but I did not actually believe that this came out of his mouth. What he'd said in Sunday school was, slavery was good for black people because it brought them to the United States. This was 2016, right? So I am fully, my black experience is very different because I was raised in a very white family, but that's one of those things that just, when you guys want to know what y'all can do, when people like that say stuff like that, call them on it. No one said anything to him. Someone came to me, because it's my job to tell him, what the hell? But that room was full of people. No one said anything. That's what y'all do.
This will probably need to be our last comment.
Just a couple comments. I don't believe in the church anymore. I still go every once in a while. One of the only things I feel like I can do is I go to every ward conference and state conference, and when they ask to sustain the leaders, I object. And then I go to the state president and I explain why. We need to get rid of the divine right of kings with the apostles. The 15 are still the 15, and too many people treat them like infallible. And we did not get a non-white apostle until the last apostle died that was an apostle when the priesthood ban was in place. We need to stop giving the ban any sort of divine room. Even this year, when the church put out a statement celebrating the 40 years of the revelation from Heavenly Father that now blessings will be extended, that implies Heavenly Father was okay with it until 1978. And, you know, it's just stuff like that we can do. That's all I got.
I'll be really quick. I'm not an intellectual. I'm not a historian. But I admire all of you here who have made comments today, and I'm very appreciative of them. I think this is the best thing we can do, is just to talk to each other and to try to understand. I was appreciative of your comments. I don't know your name. But those things help me to understand better. And then I can do the work that you're talking about, hopefully. My daughter has had a baby, and we have a beautiful black member of our family. And I couldn't be more thrilled. I couldn't be more proud as a grandmother to have this baby. And more than anything, I want to know how everyone feels, and the best way to raise this, to help raise this beautiful child who's entered our home. I think that's the capital we have to offer each other. That's the spiritual capital of loving each other truly as a family. And I think that this is a good start for that. And I'm really grateful for all of your comments. Thank you.
One final piece. My growing up years were heavily impacted by a lot of the preachings of Ezra Taft Benson, who said that we were part of the chosen generation, right? So I was thinking, by the time, you know, I hit my 20s, Jesus would be here and it would be great. He's not here yet. And I have since wondered, now that I'm a parent of three, if Benson referred to my generation in those years as the chosen generation because of the kids that we're going to be raising. These kids ask questions sooner. They ask really, really good questions, and we have to learn to equip them with truth, with righteousness, with justice, because from the mouths of babes, they say it anyway. We socialize it out of them. We have to be able to empower them to continue to speak up, and we have to be able to speak up and speak out to our friends who are saying things that are inappropriate and ineffective and that are traumatic and that are damaging our fellow brothers and sisters. I shy from making kids have to do adults' work, but I do raise my kids, all three of them who could pass for white, that you're going to be in spaces where people are going to say things because they don't know you're black. That means you're going to have to speak up. And if you ever feel like you can't, once you speak up, you come get mommy. Mommy will come and I'll have your back. That's the whole thing. We've got to have each other's back. So with the scholarship that's out there, we've got to read. We've got to know. Because whether it's anecdotes or prophets or infallibility, like if it's out there and it's written, we've got to become someone who integrates our history as Mormons. I'm huge on knowing your history because once you know it, people can't weaponize it and use it against you. Our missionaries struggle so much because people have the history, and the missionaries think, I can testimony my way out of it. You cannot. You've got to be able to own your history so that you can say it first. You got to get them from jump before they get it, before they, you know, they get the drop on you. Teach them to say, yep, you're right. This did happen in our history. Here's what we've done so far. Here's where we're still working and struggling. Can I talk to you about Jesus? It can't be, I know that Joseph was a prophet. Okay, cool, but racist. How do you address that? But polygamy. But LGBTQ communities, but trans Mormons, and faith crises and faith transitions, like, can missionaries address that? Because that is what brings folks to conversation, which then hopefully brings them to Christ, who has an infinite amount of love, and there is nowhere that Christ's light cannot reach people. But if we're not shining, it's not going to happen. We can't shine if we don't know how to light our own candles, and we do that with knowing our own history and with knowing how to integrate our history into our story so that we can then go out, bring the world his truth. So arm those babies with truth and righteousness. And if some of us need to tap out, have our backs. That's a big thing. Have our backs. We can't do all the fighting by ourselves. We need scholars. We need anecdotes. We need regular folks. We need everyone willing to stand up and to step into the gaps and to hold each other up inside and outside of the church. I got a friend who's been excommunicated 3 or 4 times. I'm like, how about this isn't the spot for you? Like, just maybe this isn't it. But there is awesome work you can do outside the church. Do that work. God's work is God's work. Thank you all for being here. Thank you to my fellow panelists. This has been a lot of fun. I look forward to the next time.
Can we give them a hand?